So welcome everyone and thank you for coming tonight. Before we begin our formal teaching, there's always the opportunity if anybody has any questions about, again, the practices we do here, meditations, or as important or more important, any questions about how do we deal with life and how do we deal with it in a way that that we're dealing with it. In other words, that the way we're relating to life is actually the way we want it to be. And that the world is not turning us, but we're turning the world. That's a very big difference. Most people live lives that are incredibly reactive. In other words, the world is always turning us, and the ups and downs and backs and forth, gains and losses of life are always conditioning us. And how we feel, and how we react, and how we speak, and how, et cetera, is all conditioned on the world. But the practice of spiritual path is to begin to take control. Interestingly enough, taking control by letting go of control. It sounds somewhat paradoxical, but that's actually the way it is. So that our mind turns our relationship to the world. And if we want to be happy, if we want to be harmonious, if we want to live a life free of conflict, if we want to have a life in which our hearts are generally happy and peaceful and compassionate and kind and patient, luckily that's all under our control. Because those are all mind states that arise in our mind. And they are predicated on how we are choosing to relate to the world. And that's a wonderful thing. Because, you know, the problem with people who want to be in control, and these days it seems like a lot of people love, you know, want to be in control. The problem is they really go about it the wrong way. Because the more they try to control things, the more things spin out of control, and the more frustrated or disappointed they feel. So it's kind of, you know, it kind of doesn't achieve what they want. So again, you know, why do people say they want to be in control, and then why do they spend so much time manipulating situations and others? It's because they want to what? They want to feel safe. Yeah. They want to feel that they have some control, some capacity to intervene in life in an intelligent, meaningful way to achieve what they want. But then they go about it in such a stupid way, which means they go about it just trying to control people and situations, which only leaves them feeling more out of control. And the more out of control they feel, the more controlling and manipulating they have to be, and you can see the endless cycle. What I suggest to people in this room who are control freaks is, you know, give it up. Let go. Right. And then you will achieve what you want to achieve. You will be at peace. You will be happy. You'll feel good. You know, and it's really the lazy man or woman's way to achieving those states. You know, because if you're always trying to control others, control situations, you know that you're having to work very hard, right? And it's often quite exhausting. What a waste of energy. Because again, essentially you're trying to control something that you can't control. So that's why I say it's kind of stupid. You know, ignorance is something, is when we're ignorant of something, we don't understand how things operate. We're ignorant of the way things are, and therefore we act and relate to things in a stupid way, in a way based on ignorance. So we want to be intelligent people. I mean, one of the wonderful capacities of the human mind, as opposed to many forms of animals and insects and reptiles and et cetera, is that we have intelligence. And that is a wonderful gift the human mind has, which means we really have the power through this wonderful intelligence we have to really perceive things correctly and to modify and change behavior to bring the actions of our body and speech and mind in accordance with reality, and therefore we can act intelligently, skillfully. But unfortunately, if we do not exercise our intelligence, and instead we exercise our ignorance, we are doomed to endlessly experience an unending roller coaster of emotionality, driven by this kind of ignorance. So just let go. Now you may be standing there or sitting there or whatever you're doing, going, oh, easy for him to say, right? But it's true. Letting go is easy. Holding on is hard. Again, it's because of our topsy-turvy minds, our minds that are upside down, that we think that the hard is easy and the easy is hard, right? It's topsy-turvy mind. So again, if you want to be happy, let go. If you want to be at peace, let go. If you want to have a calm mind, let go. Is that clear enough? Again, this can be tested in your own life. Because whenever you find yourself suffering, any kind of negative emotion, when you find yourself in various forms of emotional distress, upset about this or that, and if you understand that the source is somewhere that you are holding on to something, you want it to be a certain way, etc., etc., you will clearly see that it is only your holding on that is causing your suffering, and it is your letting go that allows you to be happy and free. But of course, then, you know, to do that successfully, you have to do something else. You have to stop living your life always with the thought, the world centers around me. Because if you think the world centers around you, and that your purpose in life is to exploit every situation and person you run into, to meet the needs of self, then you'll always be grasping, you'll always be attaching, and you'll always be holding on. So it is easier to let go. You will find it much easier to let go when you stop identifying so strongly with the narrative of yourself. That living life based on the narrative of oneself could be called what? It could be called egocentricity. You know that word? Egocentric. Egocentric means what? I am centered on myself. I am egocentric. We talk about people being ethnocentric or things like that. You know, they're centered on their ethnicity, or they could be religio-centric or country-centric or all kinds of. But the root of the problem is egocentric. We are primarily interested in meeting our own needs, satisfying our own needs and wants, and getting everybody to bend to our will. And that may be hard for some of us to stomach, to look at it so nakedly like that, because we have learned over time to prettify ourselves, right? And so many of us kind of have spent lots of energy in life doing our best to kind of look good, right? And we often use these various kinds of skills we've developed in looking good, and it doesn't mean we don't mean well, but underneath it is often a self-narrative that is using all these good capacities of ourself to underline, build up our sense of our own specialness, our own uniqueness, our own goodness, right? And of course, you know, once we go that way, of course, the only, you know, what immediately comes is what? If I am essentially good, and you know, then a lot of other people have to be what? Bad. Right? Who's bad? Everybody who's not like me. Now, when you get down to that, that can often, that includes a lot of people. So once again, we are stuck with our narrative, even if it's a good one. So even our self, our ego's attempts at goodness and righteousness often leave us at the end of the day still in the world of control and manipulation. Which means what? It breeds suffering. It breeds separation. It breeds not feeling a connection to everyone and everything. Because we hold ourselves apart in our uniqueness and differences. Again, everyone is unique and different. But that uniqueness or difference is not something that has to be accentuated. Okay? You know, if you look at advertisements, they're very interesting. They're always trying to convince you that if you want to be yourself, right? If you want to express your uniqueness, your specialness, you can do it what?
By
how you dress, by the soda you drink, right? By the car you drive. This shows the world your uniqueness, your specialness, who you are. But that's kind of silly, isn't it? I mean, we look in the garden and we see the rose, and we see the daisy, and you know. And we see the bromeliads. I mean, we see all these different things. And they're totally naked. Right? And yet their uniqueness and their specialness is readily apparent. Not by how they artificially present themselves, but how they are. Right? We can clearly see that a rose is a rose, and a daisy is a daisy, and a bromeliad is a bromeliad, and an orchid is an orchid. And they don't have to bring it to our attention, do they? Isn't that interesting? And yet, their specialness, their uniqueness is there. There's nothing that needs to be done. It's already there. It is in the flower. It is in the tree. Right? I mean, in my yard, we have lots of squirrels. Now, if you spend time watching squirrels, you notice they do have their uniqueness. They have their uniqueness in how they go about being squirrels. But even the individual squirrels have their own kind of special uniqueness. And yet, I'm sure if you brought it to their attention, they would say, I've never thought about that. You know, and yet they're able to manifest their squirrel uniqueness 100%. And they're actually free of self-consciousness. You know, they're not, right? I mean, they're not ashamed, or animals aren't private. Have you noticed that? They're willing to be themselves wherever they go. You know, we are very hidden. We hide ourselves, and we have our, you know, our secret personality that maybe we don't let anybody see, right? And then we have our kind of way we are at home, and then we have the way we are when we're out in public, and then we have the way we are at work, and you know what I mean? We have all these selves that we project according to the situation. I wonder how many of us really know who we are, having spent so much time projecting. Again, animals don't seem to have that problem. You know, I think it's one of the reasons people love their pets, right? People just love their dogs and their cats and their birds. And yet these are, you know, beings that have no artificiality, no projection. They're just themselves. And yet we love to be around them, don't we? We love to be around little children for the same reason. I'm just using that as examples to say the artifice of self and selves and things that we've developed through a lot of hard work over the years, you can really let go of. And actually, we could say one of the purposes of following a spiritual path is to return home. Maybe you've heard that. We often talk about the path is about returning home. Home to the place you never left. Well, what is this place that you never left? It's your true self. It's before all the artifice began, before all the conditioning began. Actually, in Zen, there's a koan that says, what was your original face before your parents were born? You know, which is saying, before all the conditioning, before you were named, before you were labeled, before you heard words, who were you? Who are you? It's a wonderful question to ask. Well, I have no idea how we got here tonight. Actually, I don't think anybody's asked a question. I guess that's a disease of sitting up front or something.
I feel like I'm saying, you gave us the answer before we asked
the So having said all that, are there any questions about practice and daily life? I'm sure there was many, many, many things that I left out. There may be challenges that you're dealing with in your life, or just questions you have about how to apply the teachings and the practice to real life situations. Yes, Katie.
Thinking of how even spiritually that the ego can creep in. I'm not doing this, how will I appear, you know? And that it can go even, for me, it doesn't have to be in the outer world, not the material things, but, you know, I have to really look at my motivation spiritually, like how am I practicing this, why am I practicing this? And, you know, just coming back to the self. I'm not sure what my question is, but it's really, you know, I just keep taking down the layers of what are my motives and why am I doing this? And just this usually always has to do with myself. You know, I'm going to look at it this way or I want to, you know, but a lot of times now I'm doing it genuinely because, you know, it feels like, a lot, how much, you know, just besides coming home, how much it's about how can I help? Because if I can't sit there, you know, have be focused on my form and my identity and being the center of attention, then what's it about?
Right.
Then, you know, I can be good to myself and do, you know, be home. But also, if it's not about me, ultimately, I mean, I'm really seeing that for me, it's about how can I help. So I guess it's more of a comment. But I can go there spiritually. I can go there spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the material spirit.
Katie's comment, just to paraphrase for the recording, is, you know, in the whole realm of self, one can certainly, even when and as one is practicing a spiritual path, one has to be very careful because one could be, even though outwardly appearing to practice a so-called spiritual path, Dharma path, or whatever, and yet doing it always or very much contaminated by me, and always very concerned about how I'm doing, measuring myself against my own standards or against other people, concerned about how other people perceive me, letting people know that I'm a spiritual person, or I'm this kind of person, or a selfless person, or in other words, that one has to make sure that even though one has entered a spiritual path, that one is really coming from a pure place. A pure place really means a self not contaminated, a place not contaminated with selfish motives, egocentric motives. Again, it's a process. It's not either or, it's not, it's a process, it's an unfolding. And again, having that commitment to looking deeply into the sources of one's behavior and be willing to call oneself on it. I mean, I think that is a good way to practice the path, to be kind of very honest with oneself and, not put oneself down or be frustrated with oneself, but to see when egocentricity and self-centeredness and my own needs and my own wants and my own need to look good or to get to be liked or loved or all these things aren't really functioning. So it's an unfolding. And again, you're absolutely right. I mean, ultimately, to be at least as concerned, and if not more concerned, with the well-being of others and the needs of others and how others look and not so focused on myself is certainly very much part of the path. I mean, in the greater scheme of things, we are one among many. And to be solely focused on our own needs and to distinguish them so significantly from the needs of everyone else only accentuates our sense of our own specialness and our uniqueness, and that my job is primarily to take care of my own needs in this world. But we know that that is not a path to happiness, right? Usually people, a much more direct way of happiness is to bring happiness to others. And when I say that, I don't mean in a sick way. I mean, we know in the whole world of dysfunctional this and that and codependency, et cetera, we know that, there are those people who are always focused on helping others or doing things for others, but that's all in needs of self. Those people, the whole idea behind codependency and all that, is that people are doing all these things that outwardly appear good, but they're doing it for sick motivations, which means they're doing it, again, to keep the peace, to get love, because they're afraid of losing, and they have abandonment issues, you know, so they're all coming from what we say not the healthiest of motives. So again, one can look good, right? And yet inwardly, where it's coming from is not a very healthy place. We want to be healthy, and we want our desire to be of benefit to others and to help others is because we are no longer distinguishing ourselves from them. We're no longer saying, I'm the one who wants to be happy, and my job is just to work in this world to make myself happy. It's an acknowledgement, no, everybody wants to be happy. I'm not unique. You know, nobody wants to suffer, right? You know, everybody would like to have a roof on their head, and everybody would like to have enough financial means so they feel safe and secure, and everybody would like their children to grow up, and everybody would like to have adequate medical care, right? I mean, I do. So does everybody else. So why should I just be focused on my own needs? I mean, we should tell our politicians that, but they obviously function from a very different mindset than the spiritual mindset. The spiritual mindset is based on interdependence. It's based on oneness. It's based on non-separation. My needs and everybody else's needs are the same. If I have a need for this and everybody else has a need for this, then I should always be working for what? The common good. Right? Well, because we're all in this together. So it's kind of a no-brainer. So to say, when one does not come into life from a view that's only cares about meeting my needs. And unfortunately, we have a culture these days where there are very strong messages that's healthy, right? You know, that self-centeredness and greed are healthy, and that somehow the whole will benefit. I mean, that's kind of quite distorted, isn't it? When you think about it. I mean, the whole basis of a family, right? Even in the smallest sense, is that everybody in the family is what? Taking care of one another, looking out for one another, right? I mean, I'm a father. I mean, I don't choose. Well, I'll put my son on my health insurance, but I won't put my daughter. You know, I'm more concerned about him than her. Right? I mean, people would say, "What? What kind of father is this guy?" It's ridiculous. You know, if you have a family, you want to take care of all your children, right? If you're in society, you want to take care of all society, right? You don't distinguish between my needs and their needs, right? Is that so? Again, you can see how easily, from a true practice of non-self, that the individual transformation of the one person into a wise and understanding and compassionate and selfless person easily and readily translates itself into how to act in the world and how to manifest in the world, right? It's no different. It's the same dharma. If we talk about compassion, we say what? A compassionate person is somebody who wants to alleviate the suffering of others. Right? Most people's compassion is very limited. It may extend to friends and family and that kind of, right? But we know if you take away those barriers, it just keeps going out. You know, the barriers to compassion are only limited by how we limit them. In and of themselves, the capacity of a human being to touch another's suffering and to want to alleviate it is endless, right? There's no, I mean, we can just see somebody on the street, a complete stranger who we don't know. We can see somebody in the news 7,000 miles away, and we look at them and we see their suffering, and then naturally would the response in our heart would be, how terrible, is there anything that can be done? I mean, that's kind of natural. Right? It's not manufactured.